The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 458, episode 458 for Sunday, July 14th, 2013. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer your questions, we discuss all kinds of things, we share tips, we share cool stuff found, and together we all like to learn several new things each and every week that we come here together. And here on a sunny Sunday afternoon in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in sweltering Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
Hi, John F. Braun. How you doing, man?
Sweltering? Yeah, I think it's getting into the 90s. Yep.
Yeah.
Sweltering.
That's good, though. That's good. It's nice to have a break from the rain. It's kind of how it goes in New England here. You know, we have rain and then it warms up and stays hot for a couple of days, and then it'll rain like crazy and cool off. And then we'll have a couple of days in the 70s where it's nice and cool and dry. And then the process repeats itself, rinse, repeat until the end of the summer.
I got to say, I'm disappointed, though, because I'd expect more thunderstorms with the, especially with the when you have the humidity and the, big temperature differential. That's usually, based on what I've seen, a recipe for some cool thunderstorms.
Dude, 2 weeks ago, didn't we have the thunderstorm knock out the Geek Gab for 45 minutes and we had to resume after the power came back on? Yeah. I think that's enough for us here. Before we get into the show and everything, we have two sponsors today, actually. And we'll tell you about the first one now. It's Gazelle at gazelle.com. And Gazelle is where you're going to go to sell any of your Apple products, be they, a MacBook Pro or an iPhone or an iPad or an iPod, any of that stuff that you have that you're not using anymore or that you want to turn into cash so you can get something new. Maybe it's time to upgrade. Gazelle is the place to start. They make it so easy. In fact, even if you're not ready to sell, go to gazelle.com. It costs you nothing. Gazelle never costs you anything. You go there and you look up the prices of all the stuff you have, and then you can sort of decide, well, this is worth X and that's worth it to me to trade it in and maybe get something new, or, this isn't worth it and that's fine. But go to gazelle.com, plug in your stuff, tell it what you have. They will give you a price based on the model, make, and condition. And then if you want to sell it to them, they send you a box. Again, costs you nothing. They send the box to you. You get the box. You put your device in it, send it back to them with prepaid shipping. So again, costs you nothing. Back it goes. They evaluate it, make sure it matches, and then they send you money. So they send you a box with prepaid shipping labels, and then they send you money. It really is that simple. And we have so many of you that have used it, and so many of our listeners we just constantly are getting testimonials from you folks about how great their service has been. I can honestly say that we have not gotten a single note from any listener here saying that they've had a problem with Gazelle. Everything is just gushing praise. And I've used it personally myself. And I have the same feelings too. They understand that every business is the customer service business, and they really do get it right. In fact, we told the story a couple of months ago of a listener who sent something in, said, yep, I'll take the money, and then wrote him back or called him and said, I changed my mind. Can I still get it back? And they shipped it back to him, and he was able to keep his computer and no harm, no foul. So check it out, gazelle.com. And through the checkout process, they will allow you to tell them where you heard about them. And we sure would appreciate it if you told them at Geek Gab, because that's where you heard about them. So gazelle.com. That's our first sponsor for today. And we very much thank them for being that. All right. Let's go to Larry, John. This is I was very glad to do the research to answer this question. Larry says, I'm not sure what a flock of chargers would be considered, so I'll just say a gaggle of chargers. Seeing as how I am a card-carrying Mac geek, as most of my brethren and sistren, I have acquired a few of the various iProducts over the years. I am generally not of the gotta have the first day kind on most. As such, I have acquired quite a few adapters. Many look exactly the same, save for a little size difference, such as the first generation dock connector versus the later generations. And it seems many times I am able to use an adapter from an old product in a new product. However, I've been encountering a lot of this accessory will not charge this device or whatever that warning screen says, as well as seeing the battery indicator on the screen saying not charging. I brought an adapter to the Genius Bar, which was an old FireWire adapter, and they showed me that it had a different number of pins than the connector that I would need. Apparently, an extra pin was added. The new little tiny square AC adapter that comes with the iPhone has writing so small it's difficult to tell what the amps are. I went to the Apple store, and they told me that a new iPad needs a 10 amp while the iPhone requires a 2.5 amp. The Genius told me that if I use the 2.5 amp on the iPad, I could reduce the battery over time. However, it will still charge it. It just takes longer. Plus, I have purchased various USB AC adapters from other manufacturers that are not specifically made for Apple products, but they seem to work at varying degrees. I'm very confused by all of this. I do not really understand the information. Can you help? Yeah, absolutely. We can help. In fact, Apple has done a pretty good job. You know, John, I found what you call those things, knowledge base articles called iPad charging the battery. But
sweet.
But it is a good place for anyone, even if you don't have an iPad, because it shows you what all there's a chart sort of at the bottom of this that shows you what all of the Apple chargers look like, what they do, and what they will charge. So that's a good place to start, but it's good to have this conversation. So in short, all iOS devices, and I think most USB power adapters, perhaps all, John, you might be able to either confirm or correct, charge at 5 volts. And that's important to ensure you match, because I think, but it, all you, and in that, I think all USB chargers are 5 volts. You're safe there. If you mismatch volts, you wind up blowing up devices. Amps, however, are what matter in terms of ability to charge and then past a certain threshold charging speed. Your iPad wants 2.1 amps. Your iPhone only wants 1 amp. But the way current works, if the charger supplies more amperage than what's desired, that's okay. The interesting thing is that Apple's knowledge base article doesn't explicitly list amps. Instead, it lists watts, and they sell adapters by wattage. They have the 10 watt, the 12 watt, etc. So we need to do a little math. And John, I believe I'm correct, but again, confirm or correct, please. Watts equals amps times volts. Is that right?
Yes, or when I was taking electrical engineering, the other way is P equals IV, or power equals current times voltage. So you're absolutely correct. And that's actually a key equation to keep in mind with a lot of calculations. So whenever you see volts, amps, watts, that's the relationship. And that's the again, if you're not going to remember any other formula, remember that one, because it's really going to help you with all this power supply stuff.
Right. But if you know, if we need to calculate amps, then if watts equals amps times volts, which it does, that means that amps equals watts divided by volts, because that's correct. That's how math works. Right. Still, which is great. So what that means is the iPad 10 watt USB power adapter has 10 watts of power. It operates at 5 volts, as we said before. So 10 watts divided by 5 volts equals 2 amps. Indeed, it is rated at 2.1 amps. So, you know, somewhere in there, somebody's using, you know, somebody's rounding. But that works. The 12 watt adapter, it puts out 2.4 amps. And that means that both of these will charge the iPhone just fine, because the iPhone, as we said before, only needs 1 amp. They also will work fine with all iPads. I believe the fourth gen iPad was the one that started shipping with the 12 watt power adapter. And we've all sort of taken this to mean that it will probably charge a wee bit faster with the 12 watt power adapter than it would with the 10. But I believe they will all charge with the 10 as well. But the smaller 5 watt adapter only charges at 1 amp. 5 watts divided by 5 volts equals 1 amp. And while that's sufficient for an iPhone, it's only half of what the iPad wants, but Apple built the iPad to take it. but it will charge much more slowly, as you said, Larry, and will only charge when the screen is off. If the screen is on, you'll see that not charging indicator, meaning that the power adapter is only powering the iPad, not charging it. And yes, it means it charges faster with the 12 watt adapter if you're not using it. So if you plug it into power, don't use it if you want it to charge as fast as possible. While we're at it, the iPad mini only draws 1 amp of power when charging, I believe, which is why it comes with the 5 watt adapter. So when you see those things that say this accessory won't charge this device, it's probably because the accessory is delivering less than 1 amp of power. Because we know the iPad will charge with 1 amp of power. We know the iPhone will charge, obviously, with 1 amp of power. That's all it wants. But if it and there's a lot of USB devices that deliver, you know, 0.7, 0.8 amps. That's not enough. And the devices say, no, I'm not getting involved. We're not going to let you charge because they don't. They're not getting the minimum amount of power to charge them. More amps is OK because the device is only going to draw what it needs. But less amps, not good. Did we get mostly there, John?
I think you did. I did see a question in our chat room here, which I'm not quite sure about, because there's another part of the equation here. Someone asked, if I use one of the higher powered chargers on an iPhone, will it charge faster?
There are reports that say yes.
Yeah. You know, maybe it does. But the thing is that another part of the equation is that certain devices are built to only accept a certain amount of current or power. So even if you introduce a charger that can potentially give it more, it won't necessarily take it, though. It sounds like the iPhone may.
I think the iPhone is built to charge. I don't think 2 amps is what it will draw, but it will draw more than 1 amp if available. But yeah, but Apple never says that anywhere. But there's plenty of evidence out there to support that. You know, that charge doctor thing that we talked about it. I think not in the most recent Cool Stuff Found show, but the one just prior. It's a little device from Digital Innovations that you plug into a USB port on the computer, and it tells the USB port, give me 2 amps, not just one, and will charge your iPad faster that way. It also, they have a chart on their website that shows how fast things charge with this thing. And the iPhone definitely charges faster with the charge doctor in line. So there you go.
Now, the thing to keep in mind, though, is I would say that when you take the two figures, voltage and current, the most important thing is when you combine them and you get a power figure. Power, and you may know this, Dave, I think you have radio people in your family, and radio can lend itself to building high-powered devices, is that having something that's a high voltage isn't necessarily dangerous. Like, for example, I think a good example is these Van de Graaff generators that I think we all played with in school. Those things are generating, I think I'm looking here, like 400,000 volts, but it's a very low current, so you're not going to die.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
So yeah. Be careful. So as they, in general, be careful. I mean, the power levels that come out of chargers. And yeah, I looked up, you asked me to look up. So USB is always 5 volts.
Okay. Thank you.
So it can be varying current levels depending on if sure. It's charging. And the article I saw said that, all right, if it's a USB charging device, then typically they'll go up to about 5 amps.
Okay. That's good to know. Cool. Time to, I had a, are we good with this one, John?
I think we are. Again, okay. It's good that Apple, you know, sets the record straight here, because it is kind of confusing, because you can get a mismatch.
Yeah.
You could potentially take a Apple charger and put it to a device and it won't work optimally because there's a mismatch. So.
Right. So I had an interesting experience this week. A Mac Geek Gab listener, Pete, was driving across New England, and he emailed me and said, hey, are you going to be around? You know, it'd be love to get together. And Pete and I had met each other previous times. But I said, sure. And so we, you know, picked a spot to meet. It was going to be at some point, you know, one afternoon. And I said, just call me and or text me or whatever, and let me know when you're getting close, and then I'll come out and meet. We were going to meet at some coffee shop downtown. And he says, oh, I'm going to do better than that. And so about an hour before he was due to arrive, I get this text from him that is from a service or a website or an app. And it's all actually it's all three called glimpse.com, G-L-Y-M-P-S-E.com. And what it was it was a link to the Glimpse website, but it was a special link just for Pete and just for this trip. And it showed me where he was on the road, how fast he was going, what his destination was, which of course was this coffee shop, and what his ETA was based on his current rate of travel and the roads in between and all of that stuff. And it was awesome because it, you know, it was like I got to see his in-car GPS giving him the ETA, and it was awesome. I mean, I knew I was like, okay, great, I can do work for a little while, and then 5 minutes before he's due to arrive, I get in the car because the place is only like 2 minutes away, and I met him, and it was, you know, nearly perfect timing. And it's a free app for the iPhone. You just download it and put it on there. And the cool thing is, you obviously only share these links with the people you want, but you also set a time limit. So he put his link was good for whatever, 2 hours, let's say. And then he can add 15 minutes to that in increments as he's traveling, if things slow down or whatever. But it's not like if I try to go to that link now, I can't track him, you know, cause I don't have, you know, it's, I'm not authorized anymore. So it's, it was pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah.
Okay. And I'll add to this, and actually in our chat room here, hi chat room, www.macgeekgab.com/stream.
Hi chat room.
Is where you can go to both listen to this audio live and to do a IRC based chat, which we love. So Brian Monroe actually mentioned something that I was going to second here, Dave.
Yep.
This is a feature that they also added to Waze recently. Uh-huh. Is that if other people are using Waze, you can coordinate your arrival time and see where they are. Very similar, I guess Find My Friends is another, you know, way for people to do this sort of thing. But Waze added this feature. It wasn't part of the, as far as I know, it wasn't part of the original offering, but okay. It is now. So
very cool.
Did you use it on your trip up to Maine?
We did wind up using it, and we used it on our way.
Did you get any important warnings, or did you offer any?
Yeah, and we did both. We got some and we offered some. It was actually pretty cool. It's the kind of thing I would only do with a co-pilot, because there's a lot of management to do with Waze, and constantly pressing the buttons and, you know, all that stuff seemed it was too much.
I agree with you, but I already know. So I got it down now. I mean, the two things I report are either cops or disabled vehicles.
Sure.
So I know the buttons to press here, and I can do it without looking away from the road for too long.
Yep. Yep, that makes sense.
And I won't do it if I'm in heavy traffic or something like that. I'll only make a report if, you know, there's nothing behind, you know, I'll look around me first to make sure that,
right.
I'm not doing something extremely dangerous, but it's just nice to have someone talking to you on a trip. I think I used it one time when I was driving down to New Jersey. It was like a 3-hour trip, and just to have a voice.
Even
if it's a computer lady voice. All right.
You want to tell us about Harvey, John?
I can. Let me get Harvey.
I think this will open into yet another extended conversation, but this one about Max. So it's good stuff.
Where is he?
You want me to read the question?
And then no, I got it from there now.
Okay.
What is wrong, Dave?
I don't know. Everything going to make it? You going to make
it
over there?
Open a new window. There we go.
Okay.
Got it. All right. Dear Dave and John, if you guys can figure this one out, you can share the Nobel Prize for computers.
It's mine. No.
Do they have one of those?
I don't think so. Not yet, but we can inspire them to create one. Anyway.
Hmm. Yeah,
that's right. Earning the prize is not our goal. Solving the problem is our goal.
No,
that's the only way to get the prize.
So here we go. So here, what's going on here? Recently, Verizon, which supplies my DSL service in D.C., had an outage in my area, but the real trouble started after they called to say service had been restored. Their equipment might have been working again, but my iMac, late 2010, 10.8.4, was still offline. A very nice gentleman from India was unable, after much troubleshooting, to get me back online. He scheduled a tech to come out to my house the following day. But an hour after my call, I contacted them to cancel this service. It wasn't an ISP problem after all. I have a plain Jane Verizon modem that connects to the Airport Extreme, which is hardwired to my iMac. Or I guess, in other words, an Ethernet connection. To eliminate the router as a possible point of failure, I had connected the modem directly to the Mac. After a call, another call, I added the router back into the loop and discovered I had internet service after all. My MacBook Air was online with Wi-Fi, as was my iPhone, I think also with Wi-Fi, but still not my iMac, which wasn't getting a signal through the Ethernet connection. And when I tried turning the iMac on the MyMac's Wi-Fi, guess what? It listed all my neighbor's networks, but not my own. Next up, Apple telephone support. They were able to solve the problem, or so it seemed, by rebuilding my network preferences file. Apple suggested that perhaps my iMac had blacklisted my network. That sounds kind of bogus.
Yeah, I agree.
What does that even mean?
I've never heard of that before.
Well, I have heard of network security products that'll blacklist things if they see them acting up.
But not OS X. I
do not believe OS X has that capability, at least not by default. Maybe you can program it in if you want. Okay, everything was working normally for about 5 days. Once again, my iMac couldn't connect by Ethernet and couldn't see the network via Wi-Fi. This time, AppleCare suggested reinstalling the OS. That fixed the problem again. My question is, how can I figure out if this will happen again, short of sitting around and waiting for the connection to fail? My job requires a stable and reliable internet connection, so I need to know if the problem has been solved, and if it hasn't, how to keep it from recurring. Thanks for your help. All right.
I don't think we'll ever get a firm answer to this, but I'm looking forward to chatting through this with you, my friend.
Yes, because, and I agree with you, is that we have a lot of data points here. We have a lot of things that were tried, and I think some may be red herrings, and that they may have fixed the problem, but may not have been the best way to fix the problem. But anyways, here is my response. Yeah, and we're having an ongoing conversation about this. So I wrote back and I said the following. It certainly sounds like the iMac is the source of your issues and not your ISP. And then I said, and this is where I think this discussion is more going to be about the troubleshooting. So here's what I suggested. So first I asked him some additional questions. So at one point he said he plugged the iMac directly into the modem in order to eliminate the airport router as an issue. And that's a great first step. I actually did that in some of my troubleshooting. The thing that I asked him is, what was the result of this test?
And I think it's safe to infer that he had internet access without the Airport Extreme installed.
Well, actually, his reply was that it did not work.
Okay.
So that is a little twist here.
That is,
but no, I agree with you. Because in my case, when I did my debugging, when I had the problem with my, misbehaving device on my network, and I pulled the switch out and plugged in directly, kind of doing a similar thing to rule out a part of the network, it worked for me. But in this case, when he got back to me, it didn't.
So that tells me that his computer had a complete network meltdown, and Apple's solution of, well, let's delete all the preference files and let it rebuild, is actually a great one and worked, at least for a time, for him.
The only thing I'd say with stuff like this, so if you're going to eliminate pieces of network equipment to try to solve a problem, especially with an internet service provider, the only thing that occurs to me, Dave, I'd welcome your thoughts, and then I'll try to get back on track to read.
Oh, it's fine. No, this is good.
Is that if you're trying to diagnose an issue with an ISP, typically from what I've seen, if they see the MAC address of whatever their equipment connected to change, they may not work properly until
let me crystallize what you're saying.
Seeing the MAC, if your ISP sees the MAC address of whatever the whether it be a DSL modem or a cable modem, if they see the MAC address change, they may not instantly switch gears and work with that new MAC address. It either may not work, or you may have to cycle power and stuff to kind of refresh things. But go on.
And when you just to clarify, when you say when they see the MAC address change, that's what they're seeing. But when they see the device change, so when you're moving your, instead of having your router plugged into your Verizon modem, if you then plug the iMac in, the router, the Verizon modem may still be bonded, for lack of a better term, to your router, your airport router. And without power cycling it, without power cycling the Verizon modem, it may not bond to a new device, because you probably only have one device connected at a time provisioned on your account. That's how most residential internet access is. And that's why we all run routers. And it's fine with that. So rebooting the device anytime you change what's connected to it is important. And when I say rebooting the device, I mean your cable modem or your DSL modem or whatever that, whatever it is that you got from the internet service provider. Yeah. Yep. Definitely.
Okay. So to continue with my ramblings here about I thought he should do, I also would like to get more information on what you mean when, while the other wireless devices could access the network, your iMac wasn't getting a signal through the Ethernet connection. Did you happen to make a note of the status of the interface in the network system preferences? For an interface that is working properly, you should see a little green indicator, like a little LED, and the status below should say connected. You can also view the status by running network utility, clicking on the info tab, then select an interface and view the status in the window below. In this case, were you at least getting an IP address?
Yeah, I mean, it would be curious if the IP address was, if the status is, I'm assuming it was not green, but it might have been. But if the status was yellow, that's interesting. Red means it doesn't even think there's a connection and it's not trying to do anything. With yellow, it means it sees a physical connection and it's working to sort out the IP address and all of that stuff. So it would be curious to see what that IP address is. If it's a 169.25X address, then that means it can't talk to your DHCP server, right? But Brian Monroe in the chat room brought in another interesting point. He said, what if all of that's fine? You're getting an IP address from your router and all that, but DNS isn't working right. And so you have a connection, you just can't do any lookups, and therefore it seems like it doesn't work. But I think it was more than that because, you know, the second thing he said was that he couldn't even see his wireless network listed. That's fascinating to me. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I have some thoughts on that. I'll share in a moment. But
okay. Yeah.
So to continue with my response, and then we can maybe get in a bit of his response. Then I said, I'm afraid without additional information, I can't really help you yet.
Sure.
Or especially to determine when it will happen again.
Well, yeah, there's a why here. Well, yeah, and we don't know that.
Well, I kind of chuckle because recently I was working in a customer support role, and I had someone where normally the people that I dealt with were called application engineers. They were people that dealt with customers. They didn't really want the customers dealing directly with the software engineer.
Okay.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But at one point I actually got engaged with one person.
You're a different kind of software engineer. You understand how to deal with people. Yeah.
This was a case where basically, so I'm trying to help this guy solve a problem. And basically it was a problem with their equipment. It was USB 3. And it had an impact on the software that I was supporting. And they kept insisting that it was not and the thing is, no, dude, I know. But what was funny is at one point, this guy was emailing back and forth. So number one, he would always CC his boss, which was real annoying. So I was trying to deal with him, not his boss. And then his boss wrote me at one point saying, well, John, you know, I really need to know when you're going to be able to fix this problem.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so you want me to estimate how long you think it's going to take me to fix a problem that this other guy is not following my directions on how to fix it?
That's kind of the answer. Yeah.
It was just funny. I mean, it almost is like a Dilbert strip I remember seeing one time where the boss is like, well, you know, can you plan ahead for the bugs that are going to be in the software that you're going to write? You know, it's just this mind boggling. I mean, how can you predict the unknown?
Right.
Sorry. Back on track. So what I said is in the future and just a general troubleshooting tip. And actually, I had not known exactly where this was, but now I do again because I revisited this.
Yep.
Is that you can invoke something called network diagnostics. So a lot of times, if you are running under Mac OS X, probably in Safari, and there's network problems, Safari will say, oh gosh, there's a problem with the network. I can't get to the website. You want to run network diagnostics? Here's the other way to get to it, other than a connection failing, so you can manually invoke it, is that if you go into System Preferences, Dave, and then Assist Me, and then hit Diagnostics, you can run the same Network Diagnostics utility. And this is a pretty sharp utility in that it'll at least isolate where the problem is. You know, it's at a high level, but that's sometimes useful.
Absolutely.
It'll say, okay, as far as I'm concerned, the problem is with your ISP, with this, with that, and it tries to identify what part of your network is acting up, whether it's your ISP or maybe it's your network.
Interesting.
So I suggested that as well. So it's always a good tool. A lot of times, though, it'll come up if it needs to.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah. Wow, that's cool. Yeah. So, but this thing about, I keep coming back to, you know, entire network meltdown because it wasn't seeing, not only was it not working over Ethernet. And again, like you, I'm very curious to know exactly what the system preferences was reporting for the status of his Ethernet port, you know, when it was plugged into anything, the cable modem right. or the router. But also the fact that it wouldn't even show his Wi-Fi network, but it showed his neighbors.
I finally wrapped up and said, my instinct tells me that it may be an issue with either the Ethernet port on your iMac, the port on the AirPort Extreme that you've plugged into, or the cable. And I don't know if you're doing this, Dave, but I'm separating these two issues. I believe that the Ethernet connectivity and the Wi-Fi, both on the iMac, but I think they are two separate issues.
I disagree. Okay. Only because he said that deleting the system preference, deleting the network preferences file and restarting the Mac solved both of them. So that tells me that there's something, you know, at the core of core networking, right? That was getting just totally perhaps blocked up. I don't know.
All right. Well, here's his reply. And then let's see where we go here, because I don't think we've solved this. But I think we're helping provide the tools to try to solve this. But all right. So he replied to my, you know, well-written query there. Hi, John. To answer your questions, first, the iMac could not access the internet when connected directly to the modem. Okay, so that's kind of fast forwarding.
Right.
So that surprised you, Dave, because you thought that it would work, but it didn't. So he said it did not work. Now, it could be for the reasons that we mentioned and that you may not have power cycled everybody and the ISP wasn't pleased to see your Mac there all of a sudden instead of something else. So, but then he said, when my iMac could not get online, but my other wireless devices could access the network, network system preferences showed a green dot by the Ethernet connection designation. I'm afraid I don't remember if the status said connected, but I tried the network diagnostics help available through the system preferences. It said my computer was not connected to the internet and offered no further information. Per your instinct, and then in regard to your instinct that the issue may be with the Ethernet port or cable, I'd reiterate that the iMac was also unable to see the network's Wi-Fi signal. That is, I turned on Wi-Fi on the iMac and it found my neighbor's signals, but not my own. Same time that my MacBook. All right, hold on.
No. That I'm whole concept. Done. Yeah, we're done. I mean, we don't need to read all the text. I think we've got the gist of it.
All right. I think we're done here.
But no. So the fact that it would see his neighbor's network. And the fact that this Apple support person said that it had blacklisted his local network, that, you know, if this were not the first time we've ever heard anyone even allude to the concept of blacklisting of OS X auto blacklisting a network, that makes perfect sense, right? Because if his network was blacklisted, all of this stuff would happen exactly as described. So either OS X has something that in, you know, the 8 years of doing the show and however many years before that we were doing whatever we do, we've never stumbled into, or he was running some third party software that was blacklisting things, which is entirely possible. We don't know.
Right.
You know, and I did some quick Google searching and found nothing about blacklisting networks. You know, it's just so third party stuff. Yes. But OS X automatically doing it. Come on. No, that's
now it could be. It almost sounds like, and maybe the Apple people thought this, it could be that the whole networking subsystem on the software level is having a meltdown and all connectivity just goes away for either one.
Yeah. Right.
It's not hardware, because you're talking separate pieces of hardware to do Wi-Fi and Ethernet. Last I checked. So.
Yeah.
So I don't think we solved this. So we're having an ongoing conversation here, but I thought it was valuable to bring up because if nothing else, to discuss some strategies for how to diagnose these things. Because I guess the only thought that occurred to me in the initial conversation here is that Harvey was trying a lot of different things. And is if you try a lot of different things, especially doing them in certain orders or not the right order and stuff like that, then you start creating this matrix that all of a sudden gets very complex. And now in that you want to be very disciplined in that, okay, plug this in, cycle power on this, plug that in. What's the status? Okay,
right.
Let's do it again. And it sounds like I'm not shaking my fist or even wagging my finger a little bit here, but I think for any of these efforts here, you want to be very structured, maybe even do a little chart or get some graph paper or something like that. Do a little chart that shows all the things you tried. Okay. Plugged in Ethernet, plugged in Wi-Fi, cycled power on this, cycled power on that. What was the result?
That's a good idea. When I was doing a lot of consulting, that, I mean, I didn't draw charts, but I would take notes so that I could, or keep it in my head, depending on how complex it got. But yeah, you know, you want to change one variable for each test.
Correct.
Or if you do change four variables per test, if let's say there's 12 things that it might be, change four on this test, change four on that test, and then change four on the third test. And then at least, you know, well, it's only one of these four, so I've ruled out eight already, you know, and I can now head down this path. But remember the order that you did that in, because it may be that changing something earlier then allowed for the fix to happen, you know, throughout. Many times I thought, oh, I found it. This is it. And then 2 days later, I'd get a call, the same problem. We tried the same fix. No, but you'd follow the path that you took the last time. It's like, yes. Okay. What's the, you know, sometimes it's a multi-step fix, but that's what's fun about it. So, John, I have a, I have another fun thing. We have a new sponsor.
Then I'll give you a fun thing.
Okay.
Oh, well, that's even better. Go.
Yeah. We have a new sponsor for the show, and it is FatPad, PHATPAD. And, it's pretty cool. I had never heard of this before, but FatPad is an iPad design tool, where it's more than a design tool. What's the right way to say it? It's a note-taking app plus, right? So you can create all kinds of things in this, and you can type with the keyboard, you can write with your finger or with a stylus if you have it, and then you can choose to have that handwriting recognized or not. And you can actually, in place of the keyboard, if you just want to take notes, you can write and it will transcribe your handwriting on the fly, right? So you've got this handwriting recognition system that can be used in a multitude of ways inside the app. And then, of course, you can just draw and not have it be handwriting, and you can import pictures and you can resize pictures. So you can build these pretty complex, really complex notes really easily. And it's pretty intuitive. They have a little tutorial that was built in the app, and it's just a document inside the app. And so it shows you how to navigate the app, as well as kind of teaches you the steps, and then you sort of go through it and you're good to go. And it's pretty cool. The way that it works, they you can export stuff out to PDF. You can save it out to Dropbox, which I've used. They just added, Microsoft SkyDrive support, if you want to use that. I'm glad they're a sponsor. I mean, I'm glad they're a sponsor for many reasons, but I was glad to see this app. There's a lot of note taking apps out there, but I hadn't seen one yet that really worked, in a way that it just sort of made it all intuitive. And of course it works in landscape mode or portrait mode, though. It starts you up in the very first launch, it starts you in portrait mode, but then you can use it any way you like. But, yeah, it's a pretty cool thing, and I highly recommend you go check it out at the App Store. So we've got a link in the show notes, of course, and it's $4.99 in the App Store, so very reasonably priced. Like I said, you can draw with it, you can sync via Wi-Fi. So if you have two iPads that are running this app, you can actually sync with each other over Wi-Fi. You don't even need to use a cloud service; you just do it right on your local network there. And It's cool. It also, you know, John, you can draw shapes, right? But you can turn on what they call drawing recognition or shape recognition. And when you draw a circle, it makes it a circle as opposed to, you know, whatever approximation of a circle you drew. If you draw a line, it can turn it into a line with an arrow, a very straight line, same with a square. And there's other shapes. So if you're drawing stuff, like if you're drawing an org chart kind of thing, that can be really handy to have those shapes, you know, more defined than it would be if you just had scribbled them with your finger or a stylus. So yeah, check it out. It's called FatPad, P-H-A-T-P-A-D. And it is from Fatware, P-H-A-T-W-A-R-E.com. But we'll put a link in the show notes that gets you direct to the App Store. And yeah, it's an interesting tool. I can see it good for, you know, brainstorming type stuff and that sort of thing. For, you know, for those of us that just like to blast notes down, it's a handy thing. And it's got more features than we've got time to tell you about, which is cool. Voice notes, and you can record stuff that goes along with your text and all of that. So check it out. Yep. FatPad from Fatware, P-H-A-T-W-A-R-E. And we appreciate them being a sponsor too.
Dave.
Yes, John.
I got a quick tale of woe and a quick tale of triumph. Anyways, I just wanted to give you a quick update here.
Go.
So as some of you recall, I was having this problem with packet loss.
Yeah.
This and that I was running, and I want to go through this, and it's just a good story mm-hmm. on a number of levels. At least I think so. So we were having a problem where I was unable to hear Dave. And so we looked at the Skype call stats, and
it wasn't that you were unable to hear me. I was cutting in and out, I think is a better way to say it. Right.
Right. And we determined that this was due to packet loss, or at least as far as Skype was concerned, or Skype was reporting. And for those that haven't seen this, Skype does have a special window, I think, called, if you go to the window menu in Skype, called technical call info, which tells you all sorts of fascinating things. One of them being packet loss, which is how many packets that I intended to send to you did you actually receive? And ideally, the number should be 0%. For both send and receive packet loss. If there's any packet loss, well, something's wrong somewhere on your network. Now, whether it's your local network or the internet at large, that you may not be able to determine that. But in this case, Dave, so step one, if you recall in a prior show, I determined that there was a piece of equipment on my network that was blasting my switch and was causing some level of packet loss, but there was still some left over. So then that raised the question, where is it? Is it my internet provider? Is it my cable modem? I don't know. And the thing is, I initially started over analyzing this, saying, oh my gosh, you know, how am I going to prove to the, your suggestion, your wise sage advice, Dave, was, well, just replace your cable modem, man. There's no downside to it.
That's
or at least
thing.
In my case, or yeah. At least in my case, you know, I'm with Optimum Online, and as part of the internet package, they give you the modem. It's not free. It's part of the package, but they provide the modem and they maintain it or will replace it if need be. So I had a really old one, and actually I didn't really realize how old it was. It was a Webstar something Scientific Atlanta, and I actually looked on the device, and it was like manufactured in 2004. So it was nearly 10 years old, Dave. So this is an old DOCSIS 2 device. So again, I was overanalyzing this. How am I going to prove to them that I deserve a replacement? And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to show up. So I looked my local office. So I have two local offices. So the last one I went to when I got a replacement was in Norwalk. And the bad news was they gave me the same crummy DOCSIS 2 modem when I went there.
Years, not this time, but years ago. Right?
About 3 years ago.
Yeah, okay.
About 3 years ago, I went and I was disappointed because they gave me the same piece of, piece of junk. It's a, you know, relatively unsophisticated modem. So I'm like, okay, let me go to the Bridgeport office. So, you know, I got my, you know, bulletproof vest and my, Bridgeport is a city right next to where I live, and parts of it can get kind of rough.
Yeah,
so
yeah, definitely.
I found the place. So I looked up and I'm like, oh, I hope they don't have, you know, I hope it's not street parking. And it wasn't. So it's in a shopping plaza and they have parking and stuff. So it's like, cool, you know, fired up Waze, got the right route there. Go in there, go into the place. You know, number one, I walk in, there's a security guard there. I'm like, okay, well, they didn't have this in the other office, but that's cool. And then number two, dude, it was like more secure than a bank. They had like 2-layer, 3-inch thick glass for the cable representatives. I'm like, oh gosh, is it that dangerous a job? And then they actually had these little compartments where if you had equipment to replace, they would actually open it on their side, like twirl it around to you. You would put it in, then close the door, and then they would rotate the thing. So there was never any direct human contact at all.
Dude, that's crazy. At mine, it's just a counter. I go to Comcast.
Well, yeah, and the same in Norwalk. I mean, Bridgeport is rough. Now, the thing is, they do collect payments here.
Get to the tech part.
Get to the point. Yeah. So I basically took my old modem and the power supply, put it in a bag, and got in line and waited. And then they called me there, and I said, and all I did was say, your tech support guy said I could swap the modem out. And they're like, yep.
Yeah.
Put it in the door, twirl it around. She scanned the barcode of the old one, and then it warmed my heart because she pulled out this box, and on it, it said Aeris, and it also said DS3, which I'm like, ooh, does that mean DOCSIS 3? In my personal inside voice, I said that. And she gave it to me and gave me a receipt, which it was funny because actually, they scanned the barcode on the old and new. And actually, the old one, it said device unknown. It was so old. So yeah. I think they were already phasing these out. And actually, the modem I have, Dave. So now I got a Aeris, whatever the heck it is, TM822. So this is a DOCSIS 3. It's actually a VoIP modem. So yeah. I'm not even doing the VoIP thing. So I don't think they care. I think they just want to standardize on this modem.
That's smart. The thing is, you want to replace your cable modem. I replace mine every year because I pay to rent it from Comcast. So there's no reason not to. But otherwise, I think at least every 2 years, because no cable company that I know of proactively says to their customers, hey, you're not getting the speeds you deserve. You need to come in and get a new modem. Comcast sort of infers it, but only in a general sense. They don't reach out to customers. So most people aren't like you and me, John, and those of us listening that pay attention to this stuff. Most people just go with what they have until they're told otherwise. And tech support will, if you're having a problem, tech support will say, hey, wait a minute, you got this old modem, you got to swap that out. But they should be proactive about it because it solves a lot of problems like this, where you've got these weird issues and it's because their infrastructure has updated past you. So,
right.
Yeah.
And they should proactively. So the old modem to review was a DOCSIS 2. This is a DOCSIS 3. So I got home, plugged it in. Opt Online does have a self-provisioning mechanism where it's like, I don't know who you are.
Right.
Please enter your account number and your last name and your phone number and we'll provision this modem. Well, unfortunately, there was a little hiccup, but suffice to say, I had to get on the phone and talk to the tech guy. And we actually had a very nice chat about, upgrading modems and all that. And he was like, oh, yeah, you totally should have done that.
Yeah.
I
will say the instructions that they give you, certainly at Comcast and perhaps Opt Online, but other cable companies too, is you're right. You get these new cable modems and I think every company is doing the self-provisioning thing now. If you are connected to a router, which we all are, their advice is connect your computer directly via Ethernet to the modem until you have finished the self-provisioning process. And there is a good reason to do this. I did not do this the most recent time, a couple weeks ago when I replaced my cable modem. And it you wind up jumping through a lot of hoops because your router needs to get in sync with the IP address of the modem and things change. And DNS addresses are assigned that get you into their little walled garden in order to do your provisioning. And so if you're not directly connected, you may not have that DNS address and nothing's going to work. So it is... In the end, I regretted not having just plugged my Mac directly into the thing.
In my case, it did not work because what happened. So I called them up and I said, yeah, I just got the new modem.
Right. I know yours was a different scenario, but I'm just saying in a general sense. Plug directly in. You'll even if you're a geek like us, next time I'll just plug directly in. It wasn't worth the headache. Yeah,
because when I finished the self-provisioning, it actually brought up a page saying, you're not an Optimum Online customer. Go away.
Right.
I'm like, huh? So I called him up on the phone and, I got right to someone, pretty quickly. And he was very professional. And he's like, oh, yeah, looks like your account shows that you're not an internet customer. I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. Anything to do with the fact that I just swapped out? So I don't know. I doubt that the person at the desk intentionally did this. I think it's a hiccup in their backend system in that when they saw me swap out the equipment, they for whatever stupid reason, marked me as, oh, you're no longer an internet customer.
Sure.
So he fixed it. And it was actually kind of cool because I'm sitting there, you know, I'm talking to him about the 192 page and he's like, oh yeah, you know, in the stream, you know, he was a good tech guy. And then he's like, yeah, okay. I think we're fixing your problem. And all of a sudden I saw my modem power cycle and the lights start flashing. I'm like, yep, I see the lights flashing. That's and I'm awesome. Like, oh, everything's great. So, but when I did a speed test, Dave, so the thing was the voltage levels. So the 192.
The DBMV power levels?
So my power levels measured by this modem were the same. So
good.
The only thing I can say is that my cable run is sufficient to support a DOCSIS modem.
Right.
I think but the thing was when I ran the speed test on this new modem, now number one, as some of you may know, but if you don't, DOCSIS supports multiple, we'll call them channels. And I think there's six, I looked at the screens, I think they're 6 megahertz wide or something like that. But anyways, it showed me I had 8 downstream and 2 upstream channels allocated versus I think with the old modem, it was 1 channel for up and 1 channel for down.
Right.
So that was limiting things.
That's a DOCSIS 3 thing that they bond multiple channels together. That's right.
But the thing is, even though I had the same quality line, Dave, as at least as far as power levels, with the old modem, I was getting maybe 2 megabits down and 5 up, which was like, huh? Why am I getting more up than down? Once I put the new modem in place and cycled power and everything, I now am getting, I believe, about 17 down, which I'm only supposed to get 15, and I'm getting 5 up, where I'm only supposed to get 2.
That's great. Well, so yeah, and that's why
they... the cable modem, totally, and I think it was the migration. I think what really did it is that this is a DOCSIS 3 device, mm-hmm. and it's just more efficient at allocating bandwidth or getting around problems versus the old DOCSIS 2 modem. So I'm with you in that I think you implied that they really should. It's in their best interest to try to get everybody to upgrade.
Yeah.
Because I think it's easier for them to manage and allocate and make the best use of their network as well. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they will... I would be shocked if you went in with an old, especially with an old modem, but even with a current, I mean, I just replaced a DOCSIS 3 modem with another DOCSIS 3 and it solved some problems I had. I've never had them be anything other than ecstatic to replace my modem for me. It, you know, if they give you any pushback, I'd be very surprised because like you said, John, it makes a huge difference in terms of their support if everybody's got the new stuff. So, yeah, no, that's good. And now more Skype dropouts.
For now. Now, right. You have a little nugget, I think, Dave. So I think you said you ran into this modem before. Now, unfortunately, they took this feature away, but I thought it was valuable that you mentioned this.
Yeah.
Remember password of the day. So if I bring up the DOCSIS status page on this modem, which on any DOCSIS modem, if you go to 192.168.100.1, you should get some sort of status page.
That's right.
And I think you've dealt with this type of modem before, Dave. So I'll let you.
Yeah, no, I had essentially the non VoIP version of that up until 2 weeks ago when I swapped it out. And like I said, the swapping out solved me some problems, but I don't think they were related to the modem itself. To the model of modem, I think it was just my modem had to go. But yeah, if you log in, you can see some everything all right over there, John. You can see,
yep, sorry,
that's all right. You can see, you know, power levels and that sort of thing. But then there's an advanced tab on the Aeris modems that says enter the password of the day. And Comcast with their firmware allows that password to be or that entry field to be exposed. It sounds like with you, John, OptOnline does not allow that field to be exposed. But there's a website out there. There's actually several of them, but there's a website I found that will generate the password of the day that will so that you can log in. And it really, truly is a password of the day. And so, you know, it's interesting stuff. There wasn't much more. I think I got some log level. I mean, you can't make any changes in there to do this, but you know, it's we're geeks. We like to dig in and we like to see stuff. So,
but the initial pages, the page it shows me right now is just fascinating. Even the initial one, it shows me these 8 downstream channels.
Right.
And yeah, they're like 603, 609, 60. That's why I'm saying, I think the channel width is about 6 megahertz. It also shows something, Dave, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Corrected and uncorrected.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In terms of the packets that you've received. Right.
Because the thing is, a lot of times, yeah, packets will get sent over a network and received, and they will have well, they'll be bad. There's something wrong, whatever error detection.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can recover and sometimes you can't. So it's kind of neat that it's showing me that statistic as well. But yeah, I'm thrilled. When I saw 18 megabits down, Dave, I'm like, yeah, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's what I'm paying for. That's now, actually, I think, yeah. Well, the other value I think is this. So at least these guys, and I think they could handle it. So actually, at least Optimum has this crazy service called Optimum Ultra, which is 101 megabits down, which I don't need that.
No, but it works. I've had it. I had it for like a day here from Comcast, and it's amazing to see stuff over the internet. But you got to download from people that have that speed, and there's few places that are going to, you know, give you that kind of speed. But so we have an SSD conversation to get into here.
Yes.
And I want to see if we can make this work before we run out of too much time. There's essentially three emails here that we're going to read in various order here and see if we can get to the bottom or at least share some knowledge about how to manage your SSDs. Mark will start off with, and he writes, I'm finally ready to replace my 2006 13-inch black MacBook with a shiny new MacBook Air i7 with 512 gig SSD. I don't change my Macs that often, so I thought I'd spec out the Air in order to make it last as long as possible. I'll have enough RAM and processing power to install a virtual machine on my laptop. My question is to do an installing a virtual machine on SSD and flash storage. I previously used VMware Fusion and Parallels on my iMac, and although I tend to prefer VMware, either will work for my modest needs. My VM will typically be around 30 gigs in size. I'm wondering how a daily use, constantly changing 30 gig VM file will impact on the life of the SSD flash storage and what can be done to mitigate it. Does the whole file need to be rewritten each time something is changed? I have a distant memory of an option where the VM can be broken up into smaller chunks in order to let only the parts being altered need be rewritten. That I don't recall whether that was with Fusion Parallels or both. Would running Bootcamp work better than having a VM file? I'm not so concerned about optimum performance of the VM, only prolonging the life of my storage space. So in a nutshell here, and what he's worried about is the fact that SSDs have a limited number of what's called write cycles, meaning you can only write to the drive a fixed number of times before you can only write to each cell on the drive a fixed number of times before that cell will shut down to all future writes. You can read as much as you want, but writes do have a limit. In a nutshell, I'd say don't sweat it. Both Parallels and VMware will write their image files in chunks, meaning that only the chunk changes. Would running Bootcamp be better? Probably in a very minor way, because that's only updating the files that you change. So if you don't do much in there, perhaps, you know, you wouldn't be writing a chunk as big. But really, I wouldn't sweat it. And we don't have enough hard data on this because SSDs just haven't been in use in consumer applications long enough. But there are many opinions out there that say we'll see our SSDs last longer than their mechanical counterparts anyway. So my feeling is, and this is what I do with my SSDs, is just use the drive and enjoy. It's going to be way faster. You're going to be happier. And I really wouldn't sweat it. Based on what we're seeing, these drives are built to do things in a very intelligent way, and I think it's going to last you a long, long time. So enjoy. That's basically my thoughts on this one. Anything else on that, John? Before we dig a little deeper,
I'll dig a little deeper in that I dig a quick search here, Dave, and depending on the type of memory technology they're using, you could be talking anywhere from 1,000 cycles a cell to 5 to 10, or maybe even 100,000 cycles. And it sounds like the technology is improving.
Yep.
In that, if you look now, you got to keep in mind. So you may think, oh well, 10,000 write cycles. That's nothing. Well, no, we're talking a single cell,
right,
in the SSD. And if you're talking a single cell writing to it 100,000 times, that may span months or probably years. So I'm with you in that I don't know anybody who has. I mean, the only people I know that have had problems with SSDs is where they just roll over and die.
Yeah.
But nobody where it's died or it's gotten into a read only mode, which I think is what happens when you reach the write cycle limitation for enough cells. It says that, sorry, no more writing. You can read, but that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And SSDs are built to handle it. They, but you know, even if you overwrite, and this will spill into the, you know, sort of the next bit that we're going to do here, even if you overwrite the same file, it will not necessarily write it to the same spot on the drive. So let's say you have, you know, a small file located only on one block, right? And it's block 517 of the drive. Just bear with me. Even if you say, I'm going to rewrite that file, it may write that to block, you know, 7,426 and leave block 517 alone and just mark that to be erased later. Because as we've talked about in the past, writing, overwriting a cell on the SSD requires two operations. It requires a delete of the entire cell and then a rewrite onto that cell. So you can't just write over something. You have to delete it and write. Because of that, the SSD inside itself, not even from the OS, but inside itself, will say, no, just put the data over here. I'll mark this to be cleaned up later. We're busy writing this file. We don't want to slow down for the user. So it is going to do what they call wear leveling. And that's exactly what I just described, where it's just going to spread the wear evenly across the drive. Even if you're overwriting the same file all day long, it is going to move. And that's how it should be. So, yeah, I wouldn't sweat it. All right, let's take us into Thomas, John. This is where it gets interesting.
You think so?
I know so.
And that probably means I should have a Thomas up in front of me here, which I will, and I do, or I shall.
Go.
Here he is. Open a new window. There we go. Okay. I think this is the right one. Is this the right one? Okay, yes. Gentlemen, love the show. Never miss it. In show 454, you talked about when one should use empty trash versus secure empty trash as it relates to the type of drive one has. I'm using a late 2012 iMac with a Fusion drive. It wasn't clear to me in the show which method of emptying the trash I should use. Any direction would be most appreciated. Okay. So first thing we want to talk about, what is a Fusion drive? So the Fusion drive is a invention from Apple that bonds a mechanical drive to an SSD and allegedly does things in a smart way so that it uses the right type of drive to give you the maximum speed. I think it takes the most often used files and tries to put them on the SSD portion and puts the lesser used files on the mechanical portion, which, duh, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But his question was about secure empty trash versus empty trash.
Right. And with the Fusion drive, you as the user cannot tell at all what file is on what drive.
Right. So my response to him was as follows. I think our general comment was that the secure option, by definition, will not only remove the directory link to a file, but will also overwrite the old data so it cannot be retrieved. And our observation was that with an SSD having a limited number of write cycles, constant use of the secure erase versus regular erase could shorten the lifetime of the SSD portion of a Fusion drive. So unless you are constantly using the secure option, and that was something I actually dug into a little bit, you actually can make all deletes secure deletes if you go to Finder Preferences, Advanced, Empty Trash Securely. Well, there's a checkbox. True.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the thing is, actually, we didn't mention this. So if you're in an environment where, you know, NSA, which they already know, or whatever, if you're in an environment where you're concerned about people retrieving old data from your drive, then maybe you want to turn on this option all the time. I personally don't.
Right. But here's the thing. I think with an SSD, even the secure, and this I'll read the email that John Martellaro from TMO here forwarded along from a reader of his. But even if you're using, well, let me read his letter because I think it will shed some light on this. He says,
well, to close this out though, so to wrap up what I said to him was, I think you should use the secure option sparingly. Unless you have a definite need to always securely erase things that you were throwing away. So that was my advice.
I was trying to save you from giving incorrect advice. Because with a Fusion drive, I think it doesn't matter. And let's read this note that that John forwarded along. It was posted to Macintouch where somebody said, how do you securely erase a solid state drive in a Mac? Is it even possible? And the answer was, you don't. It's not possible. SSDs load balance sectors on the fly. Just because you overwrite a file doesn't mean the associated sectors have been rewritten. The overwritten data could be on entirely different sectors, as we just described before in our description of this wear leveling, managed by the SSD controller, which means one or more sectors could still have your original data somewhere. The only practical solution is to encrypt everything and then discard the encryption key, i.e. File Vault 2. But even then, someone with sufficient money and motivation could, in theory, crack the encryption. Very, very interesting, because secure erase, what it does is it marks the file as deleted and then overwrites that file. But as we know with SSDs, it probably almost certainly doesn't overwrite the sector that that file was on. With a mechanical drive, it would. With an SSD, it almost certainly does not. So secure erase is probably a complete waste of write cycles on an SSD. Yeah. How could it? It can't, right? Though, I mean, the way the SSD controller works, this is past, way past the OS, right? You're telling the SSD, mark this file as deleted, rewrite it. And just like we described before, when you're writing a new version of a file, it's going to save the new version somewhere else and mark the that sector on the old sector to be deleted, but it's not going to be deleted because it's a waste of cycles at that point in time. It won't do it until it has to.
All right. Well, we got to wrap with our SSD buddies then, I think.
Yeah.
Because to me, offering, I mean, it's almost, I don't know if it's, you know, it's certainly not Apple's intent to mislead you, but if they're saying secure erase and if you're on an SSD, it doesn't, then it's really not.
They should warn you that secure erase doesn't secure erase on an SSD. Have you tried it on a machine with an SSD?
I do not currently have one.
Oh, that's right.
It's only SSD based.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess the thing is with an SSD, so it sounds like
There is no way to do it.
In that, so the data, so it sounds to me like the SSD is that the data is still out there.
Yeah.
I don't know how successful you'd be in retrieving it.
Well, that's
if
that's
they're
right.
doing this load balancing kind of thing. So, all right. So maybe that whatever it does in that the rewriting of data to a sector on the drive may be redundant and maybe wasteful.
Yep.
I mean, is that the conclusion
that's
that
right.
you're kind of coming to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it wasn't until I read this. I mean, it all makes sense. I had just never thought to put it together until Martellaro sent us this thing. It was like, oh, dude. You know, and there was some more discussion on this Macintosh thing. It's about two sentences, so I'll read it. He says, besides encrypting the drive, how about writing X amount worth of random data, X being an amount of data equal to the size of the entire SSD, that much data would involve every storage cell of the drive, just like encrypting the volume. And that's not even correct because, it might wind up using a cell twice during that write of, this chunk of data, unless you write it as one big chunk. But yeah, I mean, you can't securely erase an SSD. I think the file vault thing is the only way, encrypt your, and I will say, I'm running file vault on all the machines that I have with SSDs, and there is no noticeable performance hit. So, just run file vault 2 as whole disk encryption. It's managed as part of the OS. So you're not relying on some third party thing to stay in sync or whatever. And it works fine. So, throw away the encryption key and you're done.
So that's probably the best advice. And I think the encryption key is stored, is that in the recovery partition? Is that how they do it these days?
It can be, or you can choose to only restore it. Apple will store your encryption key if you like.
Right.
Or you can store it on your own. And I don't store mine with Apple. I store mine locally. Although I have since learned that Apple, when they store your encryption key, they ask for three passwords, I think. And your key is encrypted with your three passwords as the or three answers to three questions, you know, the security questions. And your key is actually encrypted with your answers. So they're not storing your key in the clear. It is they are storing the key with yet three more keys that are still yours, but perhaps more easily guessed than your, you know, whatever random key. So there is one other question. Once we finish this up, there's one other question I want to get to because I know a lot of our listeners will be impacted by this week.
Sure.
So
this week. That's timely. You better get to it.
That's the thing. But is there more on this SSD thing that that we want to go through before?
I think we need more investigation.
Yes.
I'm currently unclear as to the whole write cycle thing and the whole security and, you know, dynamic load balancing, you know, am I erasing what I saw before thing.
Right.
No, I think we got to, and we have the contacts, I think.
Yeah.
We got some Samsung buddies.
Yeah.
ODEC and those guys there, we should get the lowdown on this because it's an important question.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. It's good stuff. I love questions that make us think. It's good. No, it's good. I really do.
Don't they all?
Well, they should. Yeah. But some of them, you know, we read the question and we've already been through it. We know the answer and out we go. And that's okay too. You know, we're totally fine with that. But the ones that make me go, ooh, wait a minute. Never thought about that before. That's what I like. Walter writes, he said, there was something mentioned in the last episode that really got my attention. And it's basically the biggest tech challenge I've yet to overcome in my workplace. He says, I think it was Dave that mentioned that CloudStation, which is on the Synology Disk Station NAS units, it's their version of personal cloud. He said CloudStation was somehow better or different than Transporter, which is a standalone personal cloud solution. He says, I'm extremely curious as to your thoughts on this, as I can't find anywhere people have been really talking about a comparison on the internet. And I'm sure there aren't that many people who have had a lot of experience with both boxes. He says, I was using CloudStation as my main syncing service for work. As I've mentioned before, I have a small music studio dealing with lots of audio files that I need to have access to on my laptop and also to be backed up offsite. I probably generate 5 to 25 gigabytes of new data every day, all of which needs to be on the cloud and backed up. I was finding that CloudStation was an incredible hog of bandwidth and CPU to the point where my computer would really start acting slowly. He says, I ended up stopping using CloudStation and signed up with SugarSync as it was cheaper and more customizable compared to Dropbox. I've already gotten to the top of my 250 gig limit with SugarSync, and I'm not willing to spend more money at this point. I'm considering getting a Transporter for two reasons. One, because I could set it up at the studio where it would be sharing a wired connection with the main machine that the new data is created in, which may make things more efficient. Two, because I thought it may perform better than CloudStation after my earlier woes. What do you recommend? These are the options I see, but you may see more. Obviously, the simplest solution would be go back to CloudStation and see if I can deal. Maybe it really wasn't that bad, or maybe it's gotten better. Number two, I could get a Transporter and have it actually be in the studio. I already have a spare 2.5-inch NAS drive I could pop in there, so it would be pretty cost effective. Number three, I could get a second NAS drive in the studio and have it as my main cloud station. It may be more of a performer than the Transporter and would certainly have more features in terms of other services it could run. All right. So this is a great question, and you're right. There's probably not too many people out there that have extensively used both, and I have. And now, John, you're entering the fray with a disk station as well, so you'll have some be able to get up to speed. But there's no easy answer because neither CloudStation nor Transporter are perfect. As I see it, Transporter version 1, which is what all of you have that have Transporters, version 1 of the software, and it's a bit of a mess because of the way they store data in this fuse-based disk image cache and then mount it on your Mac as a separate file system. And it's a mess because it's a very confusing concept for users to understand. I understand why they did it. They wanted to have one file system where your locally stored data and your Transporter-only stored data appeared as one, but it threw a lot of people off. The good news is that Transporter 2.0 completely changes this model to a more what I'll call Dropbox-like solution, where you're syncing a folder of data that's on your Mac, and you move files in and out of the folder. That's the same way Dropbox works. It's the same way SugarSync works. It's the same way CloudStation works. Transporter 2.0 is something I've been running in beta here for not that long, maybe about a week. And it
can
runs.
You talk about this?
I can. Yeah, I asked them if I could, and they said it was fine. Okay. Yep. I will say that it does not run well on Mavericks, but that's okay. You know, it's beta with beta. No,
can you
no
talk about Mavericks?
I talked about that part of Mavericks. Yes. listen, you know, we use the NDA in a helpful way. You know, it's no, really, you know, this is okay. Because if people are running Mavericks, they should know this. But otherwise, it's been working flawlessly for me. And it's so much better. It's faster. It's simpler to use, all that good stuff. So for the purposes, and I'm told that a public beta or an open beta or something where you can get in on this if you already have a transporter is coming this week. That's what they told me. You know, if that doesn't happen, try not to shoot the messenger too much. So for the purposes of this comparison, I'm going to talk about Transporter 2.0 because there's no reason to talk about 1.0 when we know that all these other good changes are coming real soon now. The biggest limitation I see with CloudStation on the Synology is that you can't control its WAN bandwidth, i.e. the bandwidth it uses on the internet, or at least I've found no way to do it. So it will use 100% of whatever you have until it's finished with its operation. And I didn't read all of Walter's question, but that was a little bit of a problem with him because he's got a slow internet connection. So that's, you know, that's one thing. CloudStation, I've been using it for 2 years now, year and a half. CloudStation was pretty buggy when it came out, when it was in beta, you know, a couple of years ago. But it's now gotten to the point where it's rock solid. I would call it a mature product. It works really, really well for me. And I don't even think about it. Transporter software is young, and will stay young in that this 2.0 is really a 1.0 of the new version, right? I think that's a safe, fair way to say this because it's a whole new model. So we're going to have new, you know, new things coming out that weren't even, you know, possible with the old one. And it's a good thing. I think, like I said, the direction they're moving in is awesome. And it's great. But the transporter does let you set maximum incoming and outgoing bandwidth. So that may help. But it depends on what your issues were, Walter, with, you know, CloudStation before. We don't know. SugarSync is also likely using all your available bandwidth unless you've set it to do otherwise, and you can. So you may have dealt with that. Given that you already have a disk station, Walter, and that you can upgrade to the latest version of CloudStation, both on your Macs and on your disk station, I would try that. I mean, it harms you nothing, right? Hurts you not at all to just test it and see. And then if that doesn't work, get yourself a transporter. And I believe the coupon code MGG still gets you 10% off. So get yourself a transporter and, you know, in it goes and see how that goes. But I think, you know, like I said, neither is perfect. The transporter is way easier to set up and get to the point where you're actually doing this, you know, personal cloud thing because it just works out of the box. Whereas the cloud station, you've got to set up your Synology unit, which John could talk about. And maybe we will. We've got a little time.
A little bit.
Yeah. So yeah, let's shift into that, John. You set up a new DS7. You'll tell us which disk station you set up.
Yes. Yeah. So, as a result of my Manhattan tour, I did hook up with the Synology folks.
Yep.
And they were like, you know, Dave loves this thing and, you know, we got to hook you up with one. I'm like, cool. So, you know, we're looking at the choices here. And actually, I decided to do things not quite the same as Dave, which shouldn't surprise anyone, especially Dave. But I didn't want to get the same one that Dave got. I think Dave has a 5-bay unit. And I'm like, you know what? Let me because my needs are more modest. You know, some with 2 bays, I think I could probably work with. And so they provided me, I think it's the 713 plus.
Yep.
Is the model they provided me with. So it's 2 bays, you know, which can either handle full size or two and a half, either 3.5 or 2.5 inch.
Okay.
I happen to in a 2.5 inch. And I got to say, this is credit to both the platforms here. So I'm looking at my desk, Dave, and I have a Drobo on one side and the Synology on the other. And I love them both. They're both good for certain purposes. But I was like, where am I going to get the drives? You know, I had some extra drives kicking around. You know what? You know, I look at my Drobo and I really wasn't using the space. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to yank a couple of the 2 terabyte drives out of my Drobo and pop them in the Synology.
Smart.
And that's what I did. Now, of course, when I removed it, the Drobo did what it does. And I still got to say the Drobo does this, from what I've seen, is one of the best implementations. I pulled the drive and it's like, whoa, drive's gone. I'm rebuilding. I'm recovering. Hold on. And I'll get around to it. And it, you know, it didn't happen immediately. It maybe happened overnight, you know, 8 to 10 sure. hours. But eventually it was like, okay, this drive is no longer part of the club. And here's your data, though with less storage space. I got to say, the only conclusion I have now, the one thing, though, is that, Dave, the software that so DSM, I think, is the software that Synology offers.
That DSM is the software that sits on the disk station. That's right. Yeah. Disk station manager. Yeah.
Dude, whatever they're doing, I got to say, I am very impressed with what they can do through a browser.
It's awesome.
So you access this software through a browser, and for what I've been told, it's a Linux-based open. So, you know, so it's a...
Yeah, it runs Linux. But yeah.
But their software, but what you get through a browser interface is much richer than what you get on the Drobo.
Oh, but even
it's
with
not,
the, even
it's
with
not
custom,
good or bad.
No, it's it's, well, it's a different thing. It's, you know, the Synology
it
is.
It's a different, it's a different philosophy and a different approach.
Yeah. Well, the FS, I mean, to be fair, you know, you are using the Drobo FS and so am I, and that was sold to us as being the you know, this framework of a NAS, you know, a network attached storage solution that had apps and all this other stuff. And that part of it failed spectacularly, right? I mean, the apps haven't been updated since it came out 5 years ago or whatever it was.
Now, well, I'll give you that. They are not as rich.
Dude, that you don't have to be. No, I would encourage you to be honest.
They offer a handful of apps and they haven't really supported the community. Okay.
And they haven't updated the apps either. It's really important that people understand, if you're getting a Drobo FS for apps, you are going to be massively disappointed. Right. And I'm not saying that to poo-poo.
They have not at this point fulfilled the promise of apps on the Drobo.
And the FS never will. The 5N is a whole different platform, and you know, there's some stuff going on behind the scenes with Drobo that I think is going to, it puts the 5N in the best hands possible. So I'm really excited about the future of that. But
So here's my reflection, though. So on my initial experience with these two, so I basically did two activities, Dave. So one was set up the Synology as a fault tolerant NAS.
Right.
Like, okay, cool. So, you know, I yanked one drive from the Drobo. It you know, got upset and then rebuilt. I put it in the Synology and used their software. And I said, yeah, set it up for a redundant, you know, fault tolerant type of thing. And eventually did it. You know, I'd have to optimize it and format and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. Then I pulled the second drive from the Drobo, another 2 gigabyte or 2 terabyte. And then I eventually put another one in to up the space. But I brought that over as well. So here's my first reflection, Dave. I would have expected the Synology to say, oh, you selected fault tolerant, blah, 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 for your first drive. I'm going to do that for your second drive. It did not.
No. It allows you to say.
So to me, all right, and I understand what I think I know what you're going to say, but to me, it's not as user friendly in that it was like, oh, well, you made this drive do this. Well, I'm going to make this drive do exactly the same thing. I'm not going to be smart enough to ask you, would you kind of like to bond these together? And it did eventually. So I eventually got the software to say, okay, I want to bond these two drives to be fault tolerant. So if anything, Drobo makes it seamless.
Drobo does one thing. No,
when
and
you
I mean,
pop
this
a
is,
drive. The thing is, I expected when I put in the Synology that it would say, oh, you selected this format for the drive that I already see and you're putting in another drive, would you like me to kind of bond the two together? And it didn't even ask me that. It's like, oh, okay, I'm going to make them two separate things. So
yeah,
it wasn't very user-friendly in the sense that it didn't anticipate
It makes no assumptions about what you want to do, because right. you may want to have one volume.
Well, no, it's not fine, but it leans towards, I think, a more sophisticated user, and that eventually I figured it out, Dave, and that I had no data, valuable data. And I'm like, oh, I have to go to the part of their DSM software that lets me bond the drives together.
That's right.
To make them one.
Yeah.
So to me, Drobo is a no-brainer. You plug the drive in, and it does it. It may not be what you want, but I guess what I'd argue is for a relatively non-technical user, the Drobo. I mean, hey, you plug it in, it does what
That's been my point. I agree 100%. The Drobo is way easier to set up. For you and me included, right? You know, you put the drives in, and it does what they tell you it will do. And it totally works. With the Synology, it requires much more hands-on in terms of you plug in the drive, you tell it what you want it to do with the drive, and then it does that, but it makes no assumptions. However, this concept of the you know, and I'm using air quotes, the novice user, which novice user do you know that would go out and buy a 5-bay network attached storage device without knowing anything about what they want to do with this? And my answer is I know none. So I'm not convinced that argument holds any water. You know what I mean? If you're going to buy Drobo versus Synology,
you could be wrong. You could be wrong,
but
it's okay.
But I am happy to be proven wrong. I have yet to find that person that says me. I'm the one that wants network attached storage, but I don't want to think about how it works. Wait, what? You know, that person gets a time capsule. You know, they don't get a fault tolerant.
I think Drobo, their model is different, and it works for certain people, and that I still think it's a better device. I mean, you know, even Dave, I mean, look at these two. I mean, they're both, I mean, actually, my Drobo, you know, the FS, which we both have, has 5 bays.
Yeah.
Somebody must have decided, hey, I want a device that's kind of a no-brainer that has 5 bays. And I think the Drobo is a perfect device.
I don't think people decided that. I think that's why they had so much inventory of them. They were handing them out to us like candy. I really do. Okay. I just don't think that it's not for... There is no market. That, you know, the Venn diagram between novice user and person who wants a NAS doesn't intersect. I've told them this. I love the folks at Drobo, especially, you know, the folks I know at Drobo, and I'll leave it at that. But I'm really excited about the management there and the future there, but this Venn diagram doesn't exist. But anyway, let's quit comparing the two. Tell me about your setup with the disk station. What have you done with it?
Well, the other thing with the disk station, so the thing I did dive into, and again, I see the discrepancy between the software and the two, and I'm going to point it out, but I wanted to set up the disk station as a time machine.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Repository for my mini.
Yep.
So right now, up until recently, I had both of my computers, my MacBook Pro and my Mac Mini, using the Drobo as a time machine. And I would say that setting up the Drobo to do a time machine partition, I think is probably the best term, is pretty straightforward. You're like, okay, time machine partition, this size. And it was not impossible to do on the Synology, but it took a little extra effort to set aside a partition for Time Machine and set the size of it and set a quota and a user. So it took a little bit more effort, but that's really the extent of what I've done so far.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I'm curious to see how it, you know, because like you said, that DSM software, especially the package manager, where you can install hundreds of different things. I wrote my own package.
Well, I haven't even got there yet, but I was looking to do things that I've done already. And again, they did provide, I mean, I did the Google, and it did provide me an article that said, okay, you want to set up for Time Machine? You got to set up a user. You got to set up a quota. Then you set up the Time Machine thing. And it walked me through it. I mean, it had instructions that I could follow if you search for them.
That's right.
It wasn't, you know, impossible, but it took a little bit more work than it did on the Drobo.
Oh, way more work.
But it was cool.
You have more things that you can do. I mean, the if you're comparing the possibilities of what you can do with a you know, an FS, a Drobo FS, which again, you know, we got to remember we're comparing a 5-year old product with a 6-month old product. Right. So very difficult to do that without acknowledging that repeatedly. There's way more things you can do with that disk station. But that comes at the price of...
I haven't even scratched the surface.
Right. Oh, right. And neither have I. I mean, there's stuff I stumble into all the time. It's like, oh, I can do that. That's cool. So, yeah. No, it's cool. I'm curious how you wind up integrating with it. The only thing about getting the 2-bay model that you got is you basically, if you want to run fault tolerant, the only way you can do that, even if you set it up with hybrid RAID, which would in theory let you use different size disks, you've only got 2 disks at the moment. So you can't do anything other than essentially a mirror. So you put 2 terabyte drives in and you get 2 terabytes of data, but you can get that extension, that expansion pack. And I hope you do, because I'm curious to hear how that works. But I think you can go up to 7 drives with just the first expansion pack and maybe even more.
Well,
and
I suspect, Dave, so looking on this device, it does have an eSATA port. I suspect if I take an off-the-shelf eSATA enclosure and plug a drive in, it'll let me use that as well.
Oh, that would be interesting. Because I think the eSATA
I think essentially their expansion box is basically an eSATA expansion box.
Yeah, but you get to address the drives individually in their expansion box, right? So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Yeah. Now it's cool.
The only thing I'd say, Dave, is performance between the two. So I did some benchmarks. So I was using Activity Monitor and other things to look at the bandwidth when I was doing. So I set it up for a Time Machine, and now it's going to be my Time Machine backup for my Mini, my podcast machine. I was seeing speeds, I think, almost approaching maybe 30, 40 megabytes a second at times. The Drobo, at least the FS, and I think we've all recognized the Drobo FS has some issue with network performance.
Yeah.
So, but seeing the performance on, I think the Synology definitely maximizes the throughput for the drives that are in it.
With 4 drives in my 1513, I regularly see writes happening at full gigabit, like totally soaking the stream. It's just cool. You'll never see it. I hate to say it this way, but with the 713, you'll never see that. It's the same 4 drives I had in my 412, and I never saw it. I got about what you're getting, that 30 to 40 kind of range. When I moved to the 1513, which has exactly the same processor, same software, all that stuff, more RAM. And for some reason, more RAM, and perhaps they're doing some caching, allows those writes to happen way faster. Disk performance in general happens faster. But
if nothing else, Dave, when I start up the machine, it is there in my shared.
It mounts right away, doesn't it? Just like
the FS, for whatever silly reason, the FS, that is their Achilles heel, is that I don't know what they're doing, but they just don't, even as a phantom device. I think we talked about this, and maybe the Synology is doing this, but as soon as I open up my machine, either one, it's like, oh, it's here. Yep.
Right.
You want to talk to it? Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really curious to check out the Drobo 5N, which is their current.
Oh, is that new?
Yes.
Now, is that Direct Connect or is that their
the 5D NAS? The 5D is Direct Connect. The 5N is the Network Connect. And I am told that they were aware of all the problems that the FS had and dealt with every one of them in terms of performance and all that stuff. So I'm really curious to check it out. And they're not having open apps on it yet, because they sort of learned their lesson with doing that, but only doing it half-heartedly. So they're reaching out to specific partners, and Plex was just put on there, so you can have an officially supported Plex app like you can with the Synology. Don't get me wrong. You can do Plex with the Synology and it works fine. But you know, you don't get to pick what apps you want to install. Drobo, you know, sort of has this very, very controlled thing, at least at the moment with the 5N. But I'm curious to check it out. I mean that sincerely. It's interesting. That's the band. There they are. I thought they sounded quiet. Had to give them a little boost. feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the address to which you can send your email for us.
And just in case you experience packet loss, though you probably didn't, though it depends on where you are in the world, because we know that you may be anywhere. But Dave said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
That's feedback at MacGeekGab.com. Let's see. You can call us, too, if you want. 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That's right. You can send us audio comments or text comments from within the Mac Geek Gab app, which you can use to listen to the shows. You can use to listen to the stream when we do that every week. You can interact in the chat room there. Check out the Mac Geek Gab app, of course, in the iTunes app store. You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. That works, too. How else, John? How else can they find us?
You can tweet us.
Yes,
Dave and I are both, I think, quite active members of the Twitter community.
Yeah.
Probably me more than Dave, but hey. But anyways, on Twitter, where do you want to go on Twitter? Twitter.com/MacGeekGab for the publication. Or, I'm sorry, MacGeekGab for the podcast. Mac Observer for the publication. I am John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. And that other guy who's flying a plane somewhere is Pilot Pete.
That's all
you need to know about the Twitters, but there's also the Facebooks. And Dave, where's that?
Facebook.com/MacGeekGab is the place where you can find us. You can also find us on Google Plus. You can find us on app.net/MacGeekGab. And of course, when the stream is live, you'll find us at MacGeekGab.com/stream. We also do want to thank Michael Johnston. He is the host of the We Have Communicators podcast and the publisher of GetAppLure.com. He converts this show to chapterized AAC. He adds all the images, the chapters, the links, all of that good stuff. So thank you, Michael. Cachefly.com, C-A-C-H-E-F-L-Y.com, provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. In the podcast marketplace this month, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander from Smile, Gazelle, as we said, Squarespace, as we said, and of course, Warby Parker. It's time to order your glasses if you got your free sample. MGG is the code you can use to get your free shipping, free expedited shipping, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. Also, check out FatPad. So, John, if there were two pieces of advice I would give this week, one of them would be get off of John's lawn. And number two would be,
well, number two would be don't get hot. But thirdly,
so number three, perhaps to encompass all of those and encapsulate them into one crystallized piece of excellent advice. Go ahead, John. It would be
do not get caught.
Made up.